Catherine French, Appellant Counsel.
You may proceed.
May it please the Court, my name is Catherine French, and I represent Mr. Houseware. Mr. Houseware did not receive a fair trial. The dispositive issue in this case was all about his intent. There's no dispute that when he fired the gun, that those bullets killed his nephew. So the entire case rests on intent as a dispositive issue, yet the jury instruction regarding intent in this case was an error. The Commonwealth concedes that an instruction informing that Houseware's intent can be inferred from his conduct or his statements would have been a correct statement of law. To me, the Commonwealth is implicitly conceding that if that would be a correct statement of law in this case, that then therefore the instruction given was an incomplete statement of law. An incomplete statement of law under the law of Virginia is per se misleading, and if it's misleading, it's reversible error.
But that would be error only if there's evidence to support it, and all of the three statements preceding the officer's statement, the statements of the officer, were all inculpatory. So where is the exculpatory statements from which you can infer intent that would have justified adding the word statement to that particular instruction?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, all the statements that occurred afterwards are still statements that occurred after the incident during the interview with police, that the jury still, as the fact finder, can consider those statements in determining the intent. It's not just the three statements that were said during the actual incident.
But of course, as you know, the second instruction allows them to consider that, and now the burden would be to show, well, they must have been reading these two instructions together to mean we can consider for some reason other than intent, which doesn't make a lot of sense.
I'm sorry, compared to
In other words, the second instruction that said you can consider his statements generally for his credibility, etc., that instruction?
The witness?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You get that, and you get the natural and probable inference instruction. Why would they interpret those two instructions together to mean we can't consider what he said to the police later, after the fact, for purposes of figuring out if he intended to do this?
Well, for the natural and probable consequences instruction, which is instruction number 6, that instruction just further emphasizes that it's acts that you look at. And that's a general intent instruction, whereas this was a specific intent instruction. Instruction where I believe number, I'm not sure if Your Honor is referring to number 2 or number 20, where it talks about the defendant's statements.
Number 20,
where it's talking about the defendant's statements, 20 does not cure the defect in 7. But the difference between instruction 7 and 20 in a nutshell is that instruction 20 talks about how the jury can assess the defendant's statements, whereas instruction 7 tells the jury what they can do with those statements. And once instruction 7 is given, if it's the trial court's discretion to give that instruction, and when it's given, it has to be an accurate statement of law under the facts of the case and a complete statement of law. And here, there's acts as well as statements. Instruction 20 is all about assessing the defendant's role. That first part of instruction 20, the statements presented to you as having been made by the defendant, that's all about the jury determining if the defendant even made those statements at all, if it was a false confession, essentially, or if it was voluntary. The second part of instruction 20 informs the jury that they can decide if they believe that Houseware made those statements, what weight or to what extent do you believe that he made those statements? There's nothing in 20 that tells the jury what to do if they believe that Houseware makes the statements.
Can I interrupt you there? What about value, the value of the statements, which is not a word we typically use, but it logically means its relevance. What's the value of knowing that he made these statements to the police? Well, the value is it suggests he didn't intend to do this. Okay, well, I can address that. That's what instruction says.
Well, I think value is a term of measurement, too, of determining, well, kind of, I think it goes, value is kind of similar to weight. How much weight do we do it? But that's especially that the law says that instruction 20 has to cure the defect in 7. And when you look at those together, that at the very least is confusing to the jury. That the jury is presumed to follow the instructions of the trial court. So they're being given an instruction that says intent, state of mind can be inferred from acts and conduct. So even if they're also reading instruction 20, saying that they have the credibility and the weight, and if they go back, that instruction 7 is telling them, it's impermissibly commenting on the evidence, it's impermissibly telling that the weight, despite 20 talking about weight, instruction 7 is saying, well, I'm, as a trial court, telling you to give more weight to his acts and conducts. And that's improper. That's improper under the law. So instruction 20 does not cure the defect in instruction 7. And there's nothing in 20 that states what to do once he makes those particular statements. Not only is it an incomplete and misleading statement of
the law. Excuse me, counsel. If the instruction were worded as you contend, and it said facts and circumstances and statements, is that exactly what we seek to convey to a jury? Certainly the statements that are made by a defendant accompanying the act, they're verbal acts, they're part of the res gestae. I'm going to kill you, you so-and-so, bang. There's no question that that's a statement that a jury could consider in determining the intent. But a statement made at the police station, after the fact, the defendant is in custody, it seems to be on an entirely different footing. He's expected to try to exculpate himself at that point. And those statements, it seems to be, are entitled to much less weight in determining his intent at the time of the act. So to put those lump those right in with the statements made at the time of the act, the contemporaneous outbursts, it seems to me would introduce an erroneous standard.
Well, Your Honor, I would first say that when you look at the instructions, if you look at the law in Virginia, and if you look at the instructions given in other states, that there's instructions, when you do have an instruction of this sort, that intent can be inferred from statements and acts, and that both are together. And regarding, is there a difference between statements made after the incident and before the incident? I would say that that's the jury's role as a fact finder. They're the fact finder who determines that intent, and they can look at all the evidence. And particularly where the defendant's statements made at the police station, that was the Commonwealth's evidence introduced too. That the jury as fact finder can look at the entire statements, can look at the entire evidence, and it's their determination.
Well, then doesn't the later instruction about how the jury may weigh statements cover this matter?
No, it doesn't cover that matter because it doesn't tell them what to do with it. It might be a different situation if instruction number 7 was not given at all.
Just, they can accord it such weight as they see fit.
They can accord such weight, but it doesn't tell them what to do, what the purpose is.
It tells them to assign a value, a value, which is what's the point, what's the relevance, what's the value of knowing he made or didn't make a statement.
And I think that if you didn't have instruction 7 at all, that makes more sense that if you look at 20 and given kind of the value. But part of the problem is that you have instruction 7 pointing out impermissibly the weight and is saying that, jury, you're going to give the weight to the conduct, or you're going to give the weight to the act.
Can I ask you a hypothetical? Suppose a defendant takes the stand and he says from the stand, I didn't intend, I'm telling you guys, I'm making a statement right now to yours, I didn't intend to do this. Would that jury instruction be also in error for not telling the jury, you heard what he just stated, his statement from, consider that in determining it at the time of the act, whether or not he actually intended at that time? Why is that hypothetical different from what actually happened in this case, which is he made it long after his custody, and he made it to the police, obviously denying what had been alleged against him?
Well, I believe that it's essentially the jury's role to determine if they're self-serving or not, and way.
But my hypothetical is, under your logic, if I'm misreading your logic, correct me, but under your logic, we would have to give that same instruction, consider the statements that determine his intent, to the defendant that takes the witness stand. We couldn't just give the general instruction that says, well, weigh it however you think you should weigh it.
I think that would be the trial court's discretion to not give that instruction then. But once you give the instruction, then it has to be complete. And the issue is here is that 20 does not cure it. 6 does not cure it.
Let me ask you this. It seems like to me your problem with instruction number 7 really is the second sentence.
Correct. That's right.
And it says the state of mind of the defendant may be shown by his acts and conduct. And you're saying that's an incomplete statement because it can be shown by other things.
Correct.
And so the court is impermissibly focusing the jury's attention upon two factors as opposed to all the factors they should consider.
Absolutely. Yes. I don't have a problem with the first part of the sentence. It's that second part. That's exactly right. I mean, I also...
So can I follow up with my hypothetical because I didn't understand the response? That being, if that were the rule, and if he'd taken the stand and said from the witness stand, I didn't intend this, and instruction 7 was offered and you objected to 7, and you objected because I want you to say in 7, not in 20, that you should consider his statement he just made 15 minutes ago to the jury from the witness stand, would we have to reverse if the trial judge did not give you your instruction under your understanding of the legal principle?
I guess isn't your answer... Never mind. Make your answer.
I'm more than happy to...
Yeah, no, go ahead. You
I think that... I know that that's a different set of facts, but in that hypothetical, I think that that would be more to the trial court's discretion if it was given. I think the principle of law that would apply to all cases that I'm advocating is that if that instruction is given and the trial court chooses to give that instruction, it has to be complete and before the facts and evidence. So, yes, if the defendant testifies, the trial court, I would say that that's, then you would need, if the trial court decided to give that, then it would have to refer to statements.
So tell me if I'm misstating what you just said. So 7 would be an error if he takes the stand and we don't add to 7 his statements. We just use the general 20 instruction.
I would say yes. If I could reserve the rest of the time.
And I guess your whole thing is they don't have to give 7. You're not asking for 7 anyway. And I thought the hypothetical was, would you ask for 7? Right? Isn't that the question?
No, if the Commonwealth offered 7, would you object to it not mentioning statements?
And it would still be the same.
Correct.
They can't say talk about two factors and not the third.
Correct. Absolutely.
You have a minute and 55 seconds.
May it please the Court, Chris Shandoville for the Commonwealth in this case. I think the primary disconnect in Hauser's argument in this case is one that Justice Russell alluded to moments ago. And that disconnect is that the argument from Hauser is that he was entitled to an instruction that included the word statements so that he could use that instruction to argue for an inference that would not have been proper in this case. The argument is that he should have been allowed to tell the jury, you can infer from my statement to the police after the crime was committed that I did not intend to hurt the victim. That argument is not an argument about inferences to be made from the evidence. It's really an argument about a credibility finding. The argument is that you can believe my statement to the police after the fact, you can find it to be credible, and if you believe that statement, then you can conclude that I did not have the intent to harm the victim. There are no inferences necessary to make that conclusion. It's simply a credibility finding. So instruction 20 was sufficient to cover that argument and to allow Hauser to make the argument to the jury that they could believe that statement to the police.
So statements made contemporaneous with the act would be relevant, and we'd need to amend 7 if there were exculpatory statements made at the time of the act. But if you make it from the witness stand or makes it to the cops when he's being interrogated, there's no inference from that. You just judge it without any bias one way or the other.
Correct, Your Honor. And I don't want to concede that the instruction itself was incomplete or right. would have been incomplete. If you look at the case law that's cited by opposing counsel, the Hare versus Washington case decided by this court in 1996, an instruction is only incomplete so as to be an error as a matter of law if that instruction is incomplete as to make it incorrect. In the Hare case, the instruction that was given mentioned this discussed the statutory duty that drivers had to a duty not to stop in the middle of the highway unless there was an accident. And the instruction, there's a period there, it ended. However, the statute went on to say if there is an accident, the driver has a duty to move the vehicle to the side of the road, eventually to move the vehicle off of the road. So this court in Hare concluded that instruction was incomplete because it implied that the driver had a very limited duty but did not encompass the entire scope of that driver's duty, which made that instruction incorrect as stated. In this case, there's no implication that by instruction number 7 that the jury is not allowed to consider the defendant's statements that he made.
But you're just telling them, you look at these two, and if you want to look at some other stuff, you can if you want to.
Correct, and instruction number 20 covered that, Your Honor. And part of the other side of the coin is that instruction number 7 itself, it says facts, circumstances, acts, and conduct. And I would submit that those four things are certainly broad enough to encompass statements that he made either at the scene or after the fact if defense counsel had wished to make that argument. Certainly, his statements, his words, are encompassed by his conduct, his behavior. That's a part of that. So that instruction itself was not error and was not incomplete. It was not incorrect.
Instruction 7, would the jury know that I look at instruction 7 to consider acts, conduct, statements, if any, at the scene versus statements at the police station? Would the jury be able to decipher between 7 and 20 that there is a timing sequence there?
The instructions themselves did not make that distinction. However, the attorneys in arguing the law of the case could have certainly made that argument and made that distinction. And what my opposing counsel is arguing is that she should have been able to make an argument about statements that he made to the police, that statement was entitled to some sort of an inference as to his intent, which is not a proper way of using the law as to inferences and statements made at the time of the offense.
But you were saying that she can make that anyway, right, because of 20?
Correct.
So what makes you think that the jury would think that that was any different if you put statements in 7? Because 7 is talking about a completely different time period, right?
Correct, Your Honor. Correct.
Right.
Right. So I don't think that the court needed to include statements within instruction 7.
And that's why I don't understand why you say that.
Why I say that the court did not need to include statements?
Right.
Well, first of all, I think that statements are encompassed by the defendant's acts and conduct, because the words you say are certainly part of your conduct. And second of all, I think that you have to read all the instructions in light of the other instructions in their totality, so you do have to consider them together. And this court has repeatedly held that a defect, even assuming it were a defect in one instruction can be cured by a defect in another instruction. Washington versus Lacey and Clinchfield Cole, both of those cases demonstrate that principle. In those cases, you did have very clear defects in at least one of the instructions given by one of the parties, but they were those defects were cured by this court held by other instructions. I think one of the challenge instructions only presented the plaintiff's theory of the case, but the court found that there were separate instructions that presented the defendant's theory of the case, and that read together, there was no error because the instructions have to be read together. Secondly, I want to comment also on this argument that this instruction improperly commented on the evidence. This court has never held that a jury instruction this broad is an impermissible comment on the evidence. What this court has held repeatedly in cases that are cited by my opponent, in this court and in the Court of Appeals, Nelms versus Nelms, Keeper versus Commonwealth, New York versus Thomas, this court has repeatedly held that when an instruction identifies specific facts in the record and then tells the jury what inferences it could make from those facts, that jury instruction is improper because it impermissibly comments on the evidence. In the Kiefer case, the jury instruction that was challenged listed 6 very specific circumstances from which the jury, the instruction told the jury it could draw this conclusion that the defendant had an intent to defraud. It listed six circumstances, specific factual circumstances from the case, and said from this fact you can conclude an intent to defraud, from this fact you can conclude an intent to defraud, etc. And the court held correctly in that case that that was an impermissible comment on specific pieces of evidence. For two reasons, really. One, because it was so specific, and two, because it told the jury which inference to draw. It told the jury that the inference to draw is one that's incriminating. In this case, you don't have either problem. The instruction is not at all specific to individual facts in the record. It also does not tell the jury which conclusion to draw. It doesn't instruct the jury, you must infer that he had the intent to kill from any of these facts, or that you must infer that he did not have the intent to kill based on these facts. It simply says, based on acts or conduct, a very broad category of evidence, you may make inferences about his intent. Whether those are incriminating inferences or exculpatory inferences was left for the fact finder to conclude. So under this court's case law, that does not constitute an impermissible comment on the evidence or an impermissible attempt to tell the jury which conclusions to draw from the evidence in the record. So the jury instruction itself was not incomplete as to being correct. It was not an impermissible statement of the evidence. It was a correct statement of this court's case law. It was word for word from this court's decision in Ridley versus Commonwealth. And considered in light of the totality of the circumstances given, and a jury of average intelligence could not have been misled into thinking that it was not permitted to consider the defendant's statements.
Let me pause you there. 20 says, among other things, you can consider the value and the reliability.
Yes, sir.
So he tells the police, I didn't intend to do this. And we tell a jury, decide whether you think that statement is reliable or unreliable. How is that not inviting the jury to consider the statement and determine whether or not you believe it?
It's absolutely inviting the jury to make that consideration, which is all that my opposing counsel is asserting that the jury should have been allowed to do based on the addition of the word statements in Instruction 7. So Instruction 20 permitted the very argument that she's claiming she should have.
So in 7, when it says facts and circumstances, you get conduct and acts in 7, and you get his statements in 20.
Correct, Your Honor. And not only did Instruction 20 say the reliability of the statements, but also the credibility of the statements. So do you believe him or not? Do you not believe him? The weight of those statements.
The ultimate question is, how could a jury walk away from hearing that and think, I know he said he didn't intend to do this, but I'm not allowed to consider that because the judge says that's not allowable.
Correct, Your Honor. My contention is that no reasonable jury could have walked away from these instructions into that jury room thinking that based on the instructions that were given. And for that reason, there was no error here. And for that reason, he's not entitled to a new trial, and his conviction should be affirmed. Unless there are any other questions from the court, I'm happy to rest on my brief.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal.
A juror would certainly be confused upon the reading of 7 and 20 together. And because 20 talks about what to do, I'm sorry, 20 talks about how to assess those statements, whereas 7 tells them what to do with the statements.
But 20 says you can rely or not rely. You can believe or disbelieve what he said to the police.
Correct.
And 7 says, consider the facts and circumstances of this case to determine whether or not he intended it, including facts like acts and may consider, not only consider, acts and conduct. So why isn't the normal reading any ordinary juror, and frankly me, would be, okay, consider all the facts and all the circumstances. Acts, conduct, 20, his statements.
If it would have just said, you can consider the facts and circumstances and stop there after the first sentence, then you may be right. But by adding that second sentence, where then you're pointing out and impermissibly commenting on a particular circumstance, like Kiefer was talking about circumstances, and the court said what circumstances were improper. Here, when you're pointing out, once you start including acts and conduct, you need to follow through and have statements. And I'd also ask the court to look at the Payne case, where that essentially discusses that as well, the court can't point out what weight to give particular pieces of evidence. So I would argue that the instructions do not fully and fairly cover the issue, and that any error is not harmless because intent was a dispositive issue, and the jury's sole function was to determine that intent. So I would ask that you reverse Housewares convictions. Thank you.
Call the next case.